The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walzer, a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth. Book your free call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. That's friendofdinesh.com. Hey everyone, I'm Danielle D'Souza Gill, your host this week. Dinesh is in Israel on a Salem tour with maybe some of you listeners who are over in Israel with him. So I'm here while he's gone hosting the podcast. I love doing it. It's great. I typically do my own show, Counterculture, on Epic Times, where I push back against some of the mainstream culture. So it's fun to switch it up and do this show for a little while also. So if you like the content I'm putting out on here, make sure to follow me on social media. I upload a lot of videos onto Rumble, which is my favorite platform, but also Facebook. I'm slowly building my YouTube channel, but let's be honest, it's kind of hard to be censored on there. So definitely find my Rumble channel and my Facebook page, Danielle D'Souza Gill. All right. Well, we have a lot of exciting topics to get to today. We're going to be talking about Meghan Markle and Harry, indoctrination at universities, and updates on the January 6th trials. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and I'm excited to bring you my biggest bedding sale ever, just in time for Christmas. Get my Giza Dream bed sheets for as low as $29.98. A set of pillowcases, only $9.98. Rejuvenate your bed with a MyPillow mattress topper for as low as $99.99. We also have blankets in a variety of sizes, colors, and styles. We even have blankets for your pets. Get duvets, quilts, down comforters, body pillows, bolster pillows, and so much more, all at the biggest discounts ever. I know my bedding products are perfect for you, and I'm extending my money-back guarantee for Christmas until March 1st, 2023, making them the perfect gifts for your friends, your family, and everyone you know. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code and you'll get huge discounts on all MyPillow bedding products, including my Giza Dream bed sheets, for as low as $29.98. Get all your shopping done now while quantities last.
In the late 1800s, English nobles were facing hard economic times. The agricultural lands they held were too small to compete with the more plentiful bounties being produced by the endless waves of grain in the United States. So these once rich and powerful landlords were becoming poorer by the day. Though America was the cause of their fiscal woes, she also could provide a handy solution in the form of something called dollar princesses. These were the female heirs of rich American magnates and industrialists who married into English aristocracy. The English nobles got an injection of large amounts of cash, and the Americans got fancy titles as a sign of elite status. There were some cultural conflicts when these commoners from the colonies invaded the exclusive circles of the aristocracy, but overall, things worked out. After all, it was the first dollar princess, Jenny Jerome, who would marry Lord Randolph Churchill and give birth to the man who would lead the UK as Prime Minister in World War II, Winston Churchill. Fast forward a century and some change, and the situation seems to be playing itself out once more, but to an entirely different end. This time, instead of money, the marriage seems to be an attempt to inject some celebrity and internet influencer clout into the royal family. I'm speaking of the marriage of Hollywood actress Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex. Meghan was born and raised in California with an acting resume that includes shows like CSI, General Hospital, Suits, and movies like Get Him to the Greek, Horrible Bosses, and Remember Me. And with a stint as a briefcase girl in Deal or No Deal, you would think she'd be used to being a celebrity. After all, the royal job detail basically requires living in wealth and comfort while occasionally smiling and waving. But alas, such was not the life for Harry and Meghan. A mere 2 years later, after their 2018 marriage, came the Megxit. The pair stepped down from their roles as active royals, choosing instead to live in a California mansion, where they promised to carve out a progressive new role within this institution. Yes, it's very progressive of them. The carving has been haphazard at best. Meghan was hired to do the voiceover for an animal show on Disney Plus. She also hosts a podcast, Archetypes, where she talks about different, almost victim perspectives. There was also going to be a cartoon for kids, but that got canceled by Netflix in its early stages. But given the fact that Harry and Meghan are trying to transform an institution they no longer belong to, it's questionable how much her work in media actually accomplishes. What is clear is the couple have a very dim view of British royalty, especially for Harry, who lost his mother, the former Princess Diana, when he was a child. It's understandable that there would be a degree of hostility between him and his dad, the new King Charles, who cheated on his mother before her passing. Since then, Harry has stepped up to serve in the military in Afghanistan, but was also caught in some compromising pictures taken in Vegas. He's clearly someone who's dealing with a lot of issues. So there Meghan comes in to solve the problem. But Harry is not the first member of a royal family to experience such conflicts. And tellingly, his story is not at the center of the couple's critique of British royalty. That role has fallen to Meghan, who has taken center stage, who has repeatedly voiced her concerns on Oprah and elsewhere that the British royals are racists. This critique of the royal family's structural racism has culminated with the couple being awarded with the Ripple of Hope Award by the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Organization this month. News of this award has outraged fans of the British royalty, who point out Queen Elizabeth's historical support for civil rights leaders like Nelson Mandela and Bishop Desmond Tutu as a form of counterargument. And when pressed for examples of this supposed racism, the details are underwhelming. In one instance, the couple interpreted the question of who their baby would end up looking like as a racist remark. What's more, the incident left such a shallow impression on the couple that neither can clearly recall or will not share who made the remark and when. The fact of the matter is that Meghan never really seemed very impressed with royalty. When the Queen offered her help to learn the ropes about becoming a royal, Meghan turned down Her Royal Highness's gesture of kindness, though she surely benefited from the worldwide viewing of her wedding. She also developed a reputation for being hard on her assistants, earning the nickname Duchess Difficult. So let's be honest, there's nothing about what Meghan is doing currently that can be said to work towards the improvement of the institution of British royalty. Meghan is behaving like so many of the privileged class of leftist victims whose sole desire in life is not to build, but to tear down. Just like every other woke warrior in the U.S., she uses derogatory rhetoric to forcefully impose a narrative that makes everyone out to be a villain, except her. This despite the fact that these narratives reveal more about her own ignorance of the facts than they do about life as a member of the royal family. It is also in spite of the fact that she's also harming herself in the process. This is another key characteristic of the woke activist. We have no shortage of examples in our own country. For example, the people who run around America demanding the removal of statues and other likenesses of historical figures believe these actions somehow fix the sins of history, when in reality, this foolishness only makes it more difficult to learn from the past, from our achievements as well as our errors. Who does this benefit? Not the downtrodden in whose name these actions are done, but the tyrants who are most likely to rise to power in a dystopia where mobs feel empowered to erase history. Think about all the woke employees at Twitter, whose woke politics drove the company off a cliff before Musk came in. They became victims of their own woke ideology. Think of all the Hollywood studios that are incapable of turning a profit because their products all have to contain copious amounts of woke sermonizing. The woke ideology is in fact little more than an externalizing of one's own self-loathing. It's that rare kind of hate crime which is also self-inflicted. It's a form of societal genocide which dictates that you can't be comfortable in your own skin. Whether you're white or black, there's something wrong with you. You're an oppressive monstrosity or a quivering, helpless victim. The same goes for being male or female. You certainly can't be proud of being an American or a Brit. You have to hate yourself and your country. It's no accident that Meghan polls very badly in Britain. It turns out the British don't like it when royals use their status to turn on the British monarchy. Contrary to the corporate media, there is nothing great or inspiring about trying to spread this pathological self-hatred throughout our institutions, royal or otherwise. The British don't want to hate themselves or their monarchy, so they don't like Harry and Meghan. Americans are slightly more tolerant of them, but the more they do, the more that changes. Harry and Meghan supposedly have a documentary coming out this month about their life. The interesting thing is, it was supposed to be a tell-all sort of thing on the royal family, similar to Harry's book, Spare. That title doesn't tell you a lot. But it seems like Meghan and Harry are now afraid of the damage it will do since they've recently been trying to act like the creative control was not in their hands, even though the information came from them. It seems like Charles may have given Harry and Meghan an ultimatum, saying that if you cross this line, there's no coming back. Considering the damage they've already done, I hope so. Aches and pains come to us all eventually, whether from the normal wear and tear of time or from injury. You have the choice to feel trapped by aches and pains, or you can fight back against it. The tools are different now from a decade or more ago. Now there's 100% drug-free relief factor. I fought back with RF, and you can too. RF supports your body's fight against inflammation that is the source of aches and pains. About 70% of the over 500,000 people who try Relief Factor order more, because it works for them. You have nothing to fear and everything to gain. Isn't it time for you to get out of pain? I've heard great things about Relief Factor. If you know someone who has experienced aches and pains, this is the perfect gift for them. I know that my mother-in-law had a very invasive knee surgery with a long recovery, tried Relief Factor, and found that it worked wonders. You should give it a try too. Your first step to becoming pain-free just might be to order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of only $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That's relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246. Feel the difference. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast Julie Hartman. Julie is a Harvard graduate and has her own podcast titled Timeless. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julie, I want to start out a little bit with your Harvard experience. What was it like going to Harvard, and what was kind of just your overall experience there?
I mean, it was great going to Harvard. I mean, I was only there in person for 2.5 years because in the middle of my sophomore year, I was sent home due to COVID, like so many college students. And I thought that I was going to be able to go back for my junior year, but they made us stay on Zoom. So the only full years at Harvard that I got were my freshman year and my senior year. So when I was there, I liked it a lot. I mean, I think there's this, you know, idea that these colleges are super woke and super liberal and that all of the people there are super woke and super liberal. And that's true to some extent. But I was also really able to find some amazing friends, and I was very careful about the professors that I chose. I made sure that my professors were fair-minded. I sought out the few conservative professors. So overall, I speak highly of my experience. Although when I was there, I started off as I came in as a progressive liberal because I grew up in Los Angeles, and that was kind of the accepted view there. But then when I was at Harvard, I became a conservative. So I guess you could say that Harvard had the opposite effect on me politically that it does on most students who go there.
That is so interesting, especially because you feel like Harvard isn't as bad as many conservatives feel, yet you also kind of found your conservative views more. When you were there, did you feel like it was kind of because Harvard was so leftist and so woke that that made you more conservative? Or do you feel like it was maybe other forces that led to that? What was kind of your journey in changing your views?
Mm-hmm. My point earlier may have been a little bit confusing people. What I was trying to say is that although Harvard is super woke and lefty and they do have those people, there also are a lot of other people there who aren't as crazy as the news makes them out to be. But to your point, Harvard did in many ways make me conservative. The woke ideas there that I did see among a lot of students made me question my beliefs. And also, of course, Harvard's COVID policy, I just thought was way overdone by not even allowing on campus for a year and a half. And so that certainly contributed. But honestly, the thing that made me conservative, even more than the wokeism at Harvard, was just seeing what was going on in our country writ large. That I became a conservative in the summer of 2020. And of course, you know, we all know that that was the summer of the Black Lives Matter riots. And, you know, people were out protesting against systemic racism. And the same people who were out protesting were also telling us that we couldn't leave our houses because COVID was such a threat. So I think just seeing the hypocrisy writ large that was happening in our country really red-pilled me. And the person who influenced my thinking the most is Dennis Prager, who, of course, is another Salem host. And I found PragerU, and I read all of his books, one after the other, that summer of 2020, because I had nothing else to do. I was sitting, you know, during COVID, and he influenced my thinking so much. And so I actually reached out to him to thank him for his influence on me. And he very graciously invited me to sit and listen to an hour of his radio show. He ended up inviting me onto his radio show just to chit chat. And then from there, we developed this great personal and professional relationship. And now I work for Salem as a conservative host. So how about that, awesome. Lady?
Yeah, Dennis is so great. He's just so nice and such a great guy. But going back to what you mentioned about COVID, I think it's so sad that so many students missed out on the in-person learning during COVID, whether you were a college student or in high school or lower school. I mean, all of the learning that was lost there. How do you feel like Harvard kind of handled the remote learning aspect of maybe 1 to 2 years of your college experience?
Well, it was hard for everyone. I mean, I think that many of my professors and teaching fellows handled it the best that they could. But of course, the quality of the education was diminished. And people were extremely lenient also because we were on Zoom. So deadlines were not as firm as they usually would be in person. So look, it's just a fact that we had a, you know, step down in our educative experience while we were online. But again, I feel so lucky because at least I was in college when this happened. I can't imagine what it must be like for, you know, people who are younger, and those are really the formative years of their education. And for them to just have to be online and not, and for them to have a step down, that impacted, you know, that cohort of people way more than it would impact someone like me. So I feel kind of lucky that I just barely escaped.
Yeah, for sure. And when you think about kind of just the more social element of it, how did you think the students dealt with that? Because you can, in some ways, maybe learn things online, but it's hard to make friends online or, you know, kind of have more of those college experiences when you're not meeting other people. How do you think most people dealt with their friendships as far as not really being able to see people?
Oh, I think it had an enormous impact. I mean, I even saw it among people my age, just when we came back to Harvard for our senior year, so many of my friends said, I feel like I forgot how to socialize. I feel like I'm socially awkward now because I haven't been around people in so long. So again, I just go back to, I can't imagine like for people who haven't, you know, who are not yet well-versed in socialization, but it's a real tragedy because I just think about all the people that I could have met, all of the friendships I could have formed, experiences I could have had that were just taken away from us. So yeah, there is a big loss.
Yeah. I had a friend, she transferred to Harvard for law school, but she literally didn't experience Harvard after transferring because that was like the 1 to 2 years that it was on lockdown. So she's like, I graduated from there, but I didn't actually get to go there, which was crazy. But So I'm guessing you are in California now. Is that where you are because Dennis is there, or where are you based out of?
Yes, I'm back home in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Much cool. To my parents' delight.
Oh, well, that's nice. How are you dealing with LA? I know I've heard about the homelessness crisis there, so many issues going on in California, but what is that like kind of moving back to California now, being a conservative as opposed to being more on the liberal side?
It's a great question because I just see the city so much differently now that I'm conservative. And growing up, as awful as it sounds, I just kind of considered homelessness to be a fact of living in Los Angeles. And now that I've come home, I've seen it just increase so much. And I've also more so questioned the policies behind it. You know, what is causing this? I feel like I'm much more of an engaged citizen. But, you know, I actually had the option, thanks to Salem, of starting out in New York City. And I almost chose that because, as I'm sure you're aware, so many people in my generation, after they graduate from college, they go to live in New York City. And actually, the reason, one of the principal reasons why I chose not to go to New York City and go back to Los Angeles is because of the crime and homelessness. As bad as Los Angeles is, at least most of us drive around in our cars, which sort of provide a safety buffer. But in New York City, you have to walk or you have to take the subway. And I have had friends who literally as recently as a few days ago, one of my friends was on the subway and a homeless woman threw a glass bottle at her and it just shattered. And she said, you know, one of the pieces could have gone in my eye and gouged my eye out. So again, as bad as Los Angeles is, I actually chose it because I thought it was safer than the alternative. And that's really telling us how bad things are, because as we both know, Los Angeles has just gone down the tubes. And it is such a tragedy that Rick Caruso did not win as mayor of LA, because I have zero faith that Karen Bass will solve that problem. She was originally a defund the police person. And then, like so many of the Democrats, conveniently did a 180 and said, oh, no, I'm for the police. But
yeah, I mean, it's so hard. Right, because it's like you're choosing between two of the most liberal cities in the country. Yes. And I think San Francisco may be one of the worst as far as homelessness. If you were to kind of give a message to maybe some young people on college campuses, what would be your message to them as someone who went through that experience?
My message to them would be, you know, the most powerful thing that you can give a person is your example. And when I was sent home due to COVID, you know, I briefly explained finding Dennis and forming a professional relationship with him. I started being on his show regularly while I was still a student at Harvard. And I was really expecting people to cancel me and ridicule me. And of course, I had that to some extent. But actually, a lot of people were very kind. And that's kind of going back to what I said, you know, at the start of this interview. That there are more people out there who are silently conservative, or even if they're not conservative, they silently see that a lot of this woke stuff is absurd. And if you, through your example, show that you are resisting this stuff, it's really powerful to people. Of course, I was lucky enough to do it on a national stage through Dennis's radio show, but just in day-to-day conversation, if you speak up in a classroom and challenge the accepted opinions, if you're in the dining hall and someone says something that you disagree with, speak up, because it really, really makes an impact on people who would never otherwise tell you that it had an impact on them.
That is a great point. Well, Julie, thank you so much for joining us. The podcast is called Timeless. Julie, congratulations. Hope to see you again soon.
Yes, thank you so much.
Will the absence of a red wave during the midterms lead to a more emboldened Biden, more pork barrel spending, higher taxes, a deepening of inflation? If you're unsure how the next 2 years will unfold, talk to Birch Gold Group about protecting your savings with gold. That's why I buy gold from Birch Gold, and you can too. Birch Gold makes it easy to convert an IRA or 401k into an IRA in precious metals. That's right, they'll help you own gold and silver in a tax-sheltered account. Here's what you need to do. Text Dinesh to 989898 to claim your free info kit on gold, and then talk to one of their precious metals specialists. They will hold your hand through the whole process. Protect yourself with gold today by texting Dinesh to 989898. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and thousands of happy customers, Birch Gold is who I trust to protect my future and yours. Text Dinesh to 989898 today. I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, Joseph McBride. Joseph is an attorney who has been representing various January 6th defendants. Joseph, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here, Danielle. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, I wanted to start out by asking you, what inspired you to decide to take on some of these January 6th defendants?
That is a great question. To make a long story very short, I became an attorney because my brother Anthony was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to 15 years of incarceration for a crime he did not do. My brother's wrongful conviction and subsequent incarceration inspired me to become an attorney and to fight against an unjust system that I knew was corrupt from the top to the bottom and the bottom to the top. So when I got my first January 6th call, it was a natural progression in my career and what I believe to be a calling to continue to fight for people who are wrongfully accused or maliciously prosecuted by the United States government.
Wow. So was it after January 6th that you realized this was something you wanted to reach out to them? You wanted to find a way to help out some of those defendants?
I got a call in February of 2021 from Richard Barnett. He was in a cell next to Jake Lang, who's represented by my colleague, Stephen Metcalf. Jake essentially passed the message to Steve. Do you got somebody else who's out there who may be willing to help? I got the call from Steve. I thought about it, prayed about it, and God said yes. My family said yes. I said yes. And I took Richard's case on Ash Wednesday of 2021.
Wow. Well, give us a little bit of an update on some of the cases you've been working on and how it's been going with some of the defendants you've been working with.
So with regard to Richard Barnett, his case was supposed to be begin trial on December 12th. He is out. The government is still giving us discovery. And the most controversial charge, which is the 1512 charge, the obstruction charge, is going to be argued at the circuit level in D.C. on that same day. So for various reasons, we were able to get the case adjourned for trial to January 9th. That'll be the first actual trial that we have coming up. Ryan Nichols was incarcerated for almost 2 years. We just got him out 2 weeks ago, or maybe even less than that, so that he could begin the process of being able to prepare for trial. He was held in egregious conditions that violated his human and constitutional rights. We were able to get him out under a limited carve out under the Bail Reform Act for the specific purpose of being able to prepare for trial, something he could not do in a meaningful way while incarcerated. So he is home with his family now, I am happy to report, and he will begin the process of preparing for trial. So Richard Barnett, we got him out. We got Ryan Nichols out. We got Adam Jackson out as well a few months ago. So they're kind of in the same boat, preparing for trial at home. Daniel Goodwin as well, preparing for trial at home. And then you have Christopher Quaglin, who is still incarcerated. He is down almost 60 pounds right now. He's dying. We need to get him out. We need to get him into a position where he can see his discovery and go through his discovery in a way that makes sense. Right now, even if he had a computer in front of him, which he certainly does not, he would not be able to process the information because he's down some 60 pounds. So we need to get Chris out. We're hoping to have an answer to our motion for reconsideration in his case shortly. And then it's the march to trial for those cases that I've spoken about and a few others as well.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. And do you feel like a lot of it depends on who their judge is, who they get in these things? Because sometimes it could be someone who's just very leftist and kind of has it out for them before they even hear the case. Sometimes maybe it could be someone who hopefully actually listens to the facts. But do you find that there's sometimes some variability there?
I have to be very careful how I answer that question because I have to appear in front of these judges on a regular basis.
Okay, well, we don't want to get any of them in trouble.
It's a great question, and what I'll say is this, Danielle. Yes, your instincts are right.
Well, I guess I'll say my view. I think that it really does, and I hope that many of these people are fortunate. Maybe they'll appear before a Trump appointee or something, but a lot of the judges, especially appointed by Democrats, I mean, I think Trump was truthing about this, but a lot of them are very loyal to their side only. They're kind of want to punish many people on the other side. Whereas a lot of judges that are appointed by conservatives are much more open to hearing the actual facts of a particular case. And it's not about purely who they are loyal to. And sometimes I think these more Democrat-leaning judges want to punish the defendants, make them really sorry for what they did and so on, and give them very harsh sentences. Of course, you mentioned how some of them are even losing a lot of weight in jail. Do you have any stories to share about some of the inside stories from the defendants while they're incarcerated?
Of course. As a general matter, what we have right now is what we're calling the D.C. Gulag system. So D.C. jail was the original place where everybody was sent to be held pretrial. People were routinely tortured there. We're talking about American citizens, the majority of them without any criminal histories of any kind. A substantial portion of them are veterans, honorably discharged. Some of them have gone to war for this country and bled for this country, and they've been treated there in a horrible fashion. I've worked with multiple members of Congress to raise awareness to this issue. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Louie Gohmert, Troy Nehls, Clay Higgins, Andy Biggs, Matt Gaetz. These are some of the people who have been speaking up about this since Jump Street. And they've been saying, hey, that this is wrong. So because of the level of attention that had come to these issues, they began to move prisoners from the D.C. Gulag itself to various prisons in Virginia. So we call it the Gulag system because they're really, it's really just a constellation of gulags at this point. There's one place in Virginia called Northern Neck Regional Jail, which is particularly horrible. That is where Chris Coughlin and a few other January 6th detainees are being held. It's not just horrible there for January 6ers. It's historically horrible for largely the African-American population that's incarcerated there as well. And of course, you know, everybody else, but African-Americans are largely overrepresented in that jail. January 6ers, however, get a particular level of harm. There's a little bit more hate in all the speech. There's a little bit more elbow grease in all the pushes. And that is because the warden there the superintendent, superintendent is the correct term for him, who acts like the warden, and the people in that jail and in the D.C. Jail feel that they have carte blanche authority to treat these prisoners any way they want without repercussions. So we're talking about starvation, beatings, long stints in solitary confinement, some of them for months and months at a time. Christopher Coughlin has done easily over a year in solitary confinement, probably closer to 2 years. They keep taking him out, putting him in. They call it whatever they want to call it, medical solitary confinement, administrative segregation, you name it. It doesn't matter. It is 24 hours a day or 22 hours a day or more of lockdown in the cell, absent meaningful human contact. They are routinely medically tortured. They're denied psychotropic medication. Christopher Worrell is another example, was denied medication related to his cancer. They don't care about these guys who are veterans who are living with PTSD. They don't care about these guys who are coming in with pre-existing conditions like celiac disease and diabetes. They are slowly killing these men in order to disincentivize them from going to trial, get them to take deals that they shouldn't take in order for the government to continue to put wins up on the board. But these wins that the government are putting up on the board, these convictions that they're getting, it's analogous to a baseball player who broke a record while on steroids. He may have the record on paper, but you got that little asterisk next to his name because you know he cheated. And that's what's going on here. Be that as it may, we're going to pray. We're going to fight. We are going to do our best to represent these guys and win in this David versus Goliath battle. Because if we don't do it, the America that we all know and love will be over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you mentioned how your brother was wrongfully convicted, and many of these people are also being wrongfully convicted and mistreated. And I think it really does highlight the serious problems with our justice system, because we don't want our justice system to behave like this, where they're becoming untrustworthy, punitive, behaving in a way where people feel like this is all political. This is all just about torture. This is 1984 all over again. But when you look forward and you think about maybe the January 6th committee shifting because we've taken the House back, do you think that may influence any of these cases or how January 6th is kind of looked at moving forward. I know Nancy Pelosi is maybe trying to hide some information regarding January 6th. And I'm not sure if the committee will continue after her and decide to release this information, because as we know, there was actually FBI and other things involved there. It wasn't like, you know, what the left paints it out to be. Or do you think this may lead to the trials continuing in the harsh manner that they've always continued?
So I think the answer is yes to both. And what I mean is, number one, they're going to continue for the trials to proceed harshly, as harshly as they can, because this Department of Justice has a minimum of 2 more years. That's assuming that Biden loses the next election. But let's just say 2 more years of Merrick Garland in the FBI and the DOJ behaving like the Soviets or the Nazis in terms of how they're pursuing and persecuting and jailing people. That is for sure. The silver lining here is that, as you've correctly stated, Danielle, that we have taken back the House, that these committees will be repurposed. I hope that the January 6th committee is repurposed and it is reformatted to actually search for the truth about what happened that day, starting with the security failures and possible infiltration of government agents and or saboteurs, provocateurs, so on and so forth. People who were paid informants, non-paid informants, people who cut deals, people who gave the FBI and the United States government intelligence months out. That whole thing could have been avoided. Why aren't we talking about this? That should be spoken about. The multitude of security failures that start with Nancy Pelosi and Mayor Muriel Bowser as well, that needs to be investigated. We need strong people in these committees, whether it's the January 6th committee or something else to lead. You need a Marjorie Taylor Greene. You need a Matt Gaetz. You need a Troy Nels. You need a Congressman Clay Higgins. You need somebody new who's coming in like Congressman Corey Mills out of Florida. This is a veteran, somebody who's a patriot, a business owner who ran not out of personal need or personal gain. He ran because he loves this country. You get somebody like that in conjunction with those other players on these committees, you dig into the truth. And of course it changes the game, because the truth is what's going to cast out the falsehoods in these situations. Shining the light of truth into these situations is going to exonerate the majority of people who have been accused of January 6th related crimes, whether that is your January 6th protester on the ground or President Trump himself. And we have the people in place now to do it. The question is going to be, is will the Republican leadership, will people like Kevin McCarthy get in line, support the truth, support what the American people want to see? And that is the quest for truth for January 6th.
Absolutely. And I think so many people do want the truth. They want to know the facts. They want transparency. That's why I'm very excited Elon Musk is hopefully going to release a lot of at least things going on from Twitter. I mean, the government basically uses Twitter as a way to reach people. So maybe we'll get some information there. But when you're looking ahead to what you're hoping for these defendants, what would be kind of I guess maybe we know the worst case scenario, but what would be the best case scenario, would you say, for some of the defendants coming out of this?
The best case scenario would be a full exoneration for these guys, and for us to sue in civil court, which we're going to do, for violations of their civil rights, and for them to be compensated in the tens of millions of dollars for what has happened to them. Because what has happened to them should never happen to any American citizen. It is egregious. It is disgusting. It is un-American. It is illegal. It is wrong. And they have damaged these men psychologically, physically, their ability to generate income in this world. They have canceled them in the workplace. That needs to happen. We're going to sue no matter what the verdicts are in this case, in these cases, because their treatment inside these gulags is entirely unrelated to anything that they've been accused of that day. And it's meaningful prison reform. You know, prison reform has been an issue that has been championed by the left, the ACLU, Amnesty International, the Legal Aid Society. All different organizations from the left have been the organizations that have championed prison reform up until January 6th. All these organizations have jumped off of the map and they are nowhere to be found, simply because the people who are now really being tortured are January 6ers, largely white, Christian, Republican, God and country loving men, and they don't want no part in helping them. So my appeal to the public, my appeal to the Democrats, my appeal to somebody like Corey Mills, not Corey Mills, the new gentleman from Brooklyn, who's going to be the minority leader in the House, is for the Democrats to reach out across the aisle and to say, hey, prison reform is still important to us. Prolonged solitary confinement, which is solitary confinement for more than 15 days at a time, should be banned at the national level. We should not be jailing and putting people in solitary who are pretrial detainees, people who have mental psychological issues, or people who have physical sicknesses. We should adopt the Nelson Mandela rules as New York State did. We should ban these practices at the federal level, and primarily because these practices affect Blacks and Latinos in this country more than anybody else. So these are the constituents largely of the Democrats in urban areas. Now, we have a great amount of support for prison reform and for the banning of solitary and for the misuse of all these treatments at the federal level. And it's Republican America First based Congress members who are willing, who are coming to the table, who are saying, hey, we missed this issue for the last 100 years. We got it wrong. But now that it's happening to our constituents, we understand what you've been talking about. We apologize for getting it wrong in the past. We hope to be able to work with you in the future. Is there something that we can do together? Is there a path forward to ban these practices against the American citizen? So if you are a Democrat congressperson or a person in Senate, you should reach out to me, or you should reach out to members of the Freedom Caucus, and you should explore the possibility of putting down the gauntlet and doing what is best for the American people to ban these heinous and satanic practices in our prisons, because they are evil, they have no place in American society, and they are absolutely wrong.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw Dave Chappelle's SNL monologue, but he talked about how all of these things that conservatives are pushing for right now, you know, with race and defunding the FBI, he was saying the Blacks have been pushing for this as well, because a lot of the things happening to conservatives now are things that were happening to Black people, many of whom are maybe conservative now. But I think that it does show that we can't have this overpowerful government, whether that's our justice system or the prison system, because it can be misused and abused. And the larger the system becomes, the larger the cesspool becomes, the more room there is for them to torture people who are against them. And we're just seeing that happen on such a grand scale to these defendants. Well, Joseph, good luck with everything. Keep us updated on how it goes. And we will definitely be keeping them in our thoughts and prayers.
Thank you, Danielle. It's good to see you. God bless you and God bless America.
I try to eat healthy, but I'm not a big fan of the flavor of veggies. But I have to admit, when I'm in the produce section, all those vibrant colors of fruits and veggies look really good. Dr. Howard at Balance of Nature told us that all those colors you see in the produce section equal nutritional variety. Different colors signify different key nutrients. If you eat only your favorite one or two veggies, you're missing a whole world of vital nutrients. That's why I take these 6 little fruits and veggie capsules each day. Each daily dose is made up of a blend of 31 different fruits and veggies, and that's the only way we can possibly get what we need. So give your body everything it needs with Balance of Nature. For a limited time, all new preferred customers will receive an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America.
Are you watching your retirement slip through your hands every day? Are you worried about a black swan market event that is inevitably coming? This is an event that comes out of nowhere and basically decimates your accumulated savings. And that's not all. Interest rates going up, inflation skyrocketing. How can we protect our money? How can you get ahead of what's happening with the economy? This is not a time to wing it or go with a hunch. You need a qualified expert on your side. Well, I'm not an expert, but my friend Rebecca Walzer is. She is a tax attorney and wealth strategist with her MBA from the London School of Economics. Rebecca and her team will help to prepare you and your money for the turbulent times ahead. We all work hard for our money, and we can use some really good guidance to help us build on what we have. Go to friendofdinesh.com and book your complimentary intro call today to see if you qualify. That's friendofdinesh.com. Let Rebecca Walzer's team of experts protect your wealth during these unprecedented times.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. Or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. three-star general, Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.